Now, Catherine Whitehorn presents her point of view. She reflects on the diseconomies of scale.
In Monday's papers, there was a news item about a way of stopping the HIV virus getting hold of healthy cells. And there were pictures of them, looking like the kind of baubles you hang on a Christmas tree. We take it for granted we have pictures of such things, which are infinitely small and certainly couldn't be seen with the naked eye. And at the other end of the scale, we now count in zillions, well, not me personally, but someone, the unimaginable distances that it's calculated some of the furthest stars in the universe may be. What has become completely irrelevant is any idea of scale based on us human beings. Which doesn't particularly matter as far as science is concerned. Scientists are used to thinking in such terms. But somewhere along the line, we seem to have lost our sense of the scale of what works for people and groups of people. Instant communication systems, incredible ways of using steel and glass, have made it possible to build bigger and bigger buildings, larger merged organisations, wider alliances, huger institutions, and some of it's a disaster. I know it's said that such giants can work with streamlined and cheaper efficiency, but to my mind, there's a downside. In Robert Graves' book, Count Belisarius, he wrote that when they told Belisarius that an army of 100,000 troops was mustering against him, he would calmly say, "Very few generals can manage an army of 100,000. And when they said, "It's now 150,000, he'd say, "Even fewer generals can manage an army of 150,000. Exactly. But the army, actually, bad though it may be at the provision of enough body armour or clean married quarters, does know how to divide itself into manageable bits. Even a battalion is usually only about 600. A major commands a company that isn't more than 200, and he's expected to know all their names. And a captain or a lieutenant deals with a platoon of just 40 to 50 people. It has learned that this is what works. It isn't just generals either who need to be brilliant to cope with vast numbers. A short time ago, there was a report which found that behavioural problems were much worse in really large comprehensives than in smaller schools. And I can't have been the only one growling, "Well, of course." The whole argument about whether comprehensives are better, worse, or the same as the old unfair 11+ has left this out, that half the problems of vast comprehensives are nothing to do with mixed ability, everything to do with sheer size. But aren't the renowned public schools also huge? Yes, and they mostly work okay, at least in terms of an absence of riot and GBH. But they're broken down into houses of a smaller size, with a housemaster and a house tutor, not to mention a matron, so there are always at least one or two people who know about every single boy or girl. A head in charge of 1,500 pupils can't know about more than a few of them. The place takes an entirely different kind of control. Certainly there are some marvellous heads who do make brilliant schools, even out of these huge comprehensives, but never enough. It's far harder. Yet my local borough, Camden, in sore need of a new school in the south of the borough, is not building one of a sensible size there. It's determined to have one mammoth school to serve a far wider area. Grandiose ideas, big projects, thinking big. It always seems so attractive, but it can be a crucial mistake. The vast projects built after the war to relieve the dismal slums of the past are the lawless sink estates of today. In many ways, they don't work as well as the old, insanitary, huddled cottages. Baroness Mary Stocks was pointing out decades ago that the wide, green communal spaces, beloved of 60s idealists, were far less satisfying, psychologically, than the grotty little backyards, where a family could keep its rabbits, its nasturtiums, its rusty pram that might or might not be needed again. And it's not only modern schemes that can be too big. Look at some of the ghastly Victorian institutions. In the early 80s, Albert Kuschlik, a charismatic doctor in Southampton, realised that when badly disabled children were sent out to such vast asylums in the country, their families found it hard to visit, and dispirited mothers gave up bringing their children new clothes because the communal laundry reduced them all to grey rags. He figured out that in a town the size of Southampton, about 200,000 people, there were only about 40 such children, So he started two houses, one in the north of the town, one in the south, for around 20 children each. These were feasibly near their families, who could identify with the place, visit their kids often, give clothes to their own children that could be washed in a domestic washing machine, and go on looking like real clothes. Parents could get to know the staff well, and help out overnight if a professional went sick. You'd think by now some of this might have sunk in. It's 30 years, after all, since Sir Frederick Catherwood was lecturing on the diseconomies of scale. But even recently they've been talking about super jails. Well, at least they've stopped erecting such vast bins for people with mental health problems, and University College Hospital, already big enough to house 100 sick elephants, has dropped its idiotic plan, for the time being, for a merger with the Royal Free, which would have required even more communication systems and even more disruption when, as always will happen, the systems break down. And it's not just mechanical systems either. In another hospital, Southampton again, the consultants, according to a brain surgeon friend of mine, all used to meet on a Friday for lunch and swap knowledge about patients and problems. Then came an expansion, with everyone eating in a huge democratic hall, and this invaluable time of communication was lost. So it goes. I think the question of size is not even just about organisational efficiency. It also affects what motivates people to do what they do. A few fanatics, geniuses or saints may strive only to match their own ambitions, to climb the highest mountain, fast for a fortnight, memorise the whole of Paradise Lost. But most people simply want to relate to those around them. I've heard it said that about 11 is the maximum useful unit, for example, for those asked to do anything really dangerous and difficult, the same number for frontline soldiers and people 100 feet down a mine. A man will put himself at serious risk to save one of his mates, but not for the 29th miner down the line. And surely some of the glue that holds society together, makes people behave one way or another, is simply how they will measure up to those around them. You might say that everyone works for money, and so of course they do, to the extent of liking a car that doesn't break down, pretty clothes and a warm house. But the really big bucks are about something else, about being top dog, or top bitch, I suppose. The women who pay £2,000 for a handbag are not really saying it's so beautiful it's worth that daft sum of money. They want it because it costs so much and proves how well they're doing. As it is for the idiot who'll pay £500 for a bottle of wine long after he's too far gone to appreciate it, he's simply saying, "I'm a bigger tiger than you are," to those whose opinion he cares about. Money is how you keep score. And in a globalised world, it tends to be the only way, that's the trouble. In the city, there used to be such a thing as shame, but that was before it all went worldwide. In Edith Wharton's book, The Age of Innocence, set in mid-19th century New York, the banker Julius indulges in some shady business, and no one will speak to him at the opera. Socially, he is ruined. There's nothing like that now. The financial world, like so much else, is just too big. Who in our world is going to make even suspected fraudsters like Madoff or Stanford feel ostracised and despised? No matter how many communes anybody invents, the family always creeps back, said anthropologist Margaret Mead. Communes aren't in fashion right now, it's conglomerates and global empires. But in the end, we can all relate only to a certain number of people, a unity more or less like a family. So I'm not trying to be coarse if I simply say size does matter.
A Point of View was presented by Catherine Whitehorn and produced by Clive Brill. It was a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4.